So, we've been having poetry readings with River Styx since 1974. So talk about history in the perfect past. But tonight we're going to be breaking from tradition and history just a little bit and acknowledging history and tradition. Because for the first time we're going to have a historian come up here and talk to us. That would probably make some of our beatnik predecessors.
Lord Nemiroff and Wallace Stegner, philosophers, poets, neurologists, psychologists, historians, anthropologists. They are here together in this room because I invited them, an odd assortment never before gathered together in this way, in this order, on these shelves, by anyone, ever. These books and the sequence in which I acquired them and the order in which I have put them are a sort of history, a history of the conversations I have had with their authors and within myself, rectangular reminders of how my mind has soared and circled and plummeted to, and in them I retrace my route. They are multicolored markers, personal guideposts along a path, and I follow them to know the way I came. Here in this small room, I have put these people together, encapsulating their own thoughts and my own search for meanings. Because I am alive here and now, I am the medium for the conversations that ensue among all of these people, dead and gone, or alive and far away. I am thinking of St. Augustine, gray and black-bound book, from his Confessions. These things do I within, in that vast court of my memory. For there are present with me heaven, earth, sea, and whatever I could think on therein, besides what I have forgotten. There also I meet with myself and recall myself, and when and where and what I have done and under what feelings. Great is the power of memory. A fearful thing, O my God, a deep and boundless manifoldness. And this thing is the mind, and this I am myself. Some of the books on the shelves are only distant whispers in the court of my own memory, while others speak almost daily. One of the loquacious ones is Norman MacLean, who told me on several occasions when we visited that he hoped A River Runs Through It would never become a movie. His closing words in this story, it's a blue-colored book on the shelf by the window, are ones that I keep trying to grow into. So they play through my own mind at odd times. You have heard them before, but listen. Now nearly all those I loved and did not understand when I was young are dead, but I still reach out to them. Of course, now I am too old to be much of a fisherman, and now, of course, I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. Like many fly fishermen in western Montana, where the summer days are almost arctic in length, I often do not start fishing until the cool of the evening. Then, in the arctic half-light of the canyon, all existence fades to a being with my soul. And the memories and the sounds of the big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, all things merge into one and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are the words and some of the words are theirs. I am haunted by waters. Dear Mr. Norman MacLean, I am haunted by your words. They alter their meanings by darkness and daylight, with the seasons, with death, and with continuation of life. Thinking about them makes me wonder about myself at middle age and my shallow explanations that are supplanted by awe, by a growing sense of sacredness that gives your words change sense. You knew that, didn't you? You struggled for decades to write those 172 words. If I could sit with you one more time, I would say to you, it was worth a lifetime. I was trout fisherman enough to tingle at your analogy. While you were growing up in Montana in the early days of this century, John Volker was raised in my hometown on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. You were of the same generation. He wrote under the pen name of Robert Traver, Anatomy of a Murder, among other works. And I have an unpublished manuscript of his here in this room, titled Burning Earth. I remember him sitting in my living room, full of bourbon, wrapped in an old many-colored Hudson's Bay blanket, making up rhymes all night. Like you, he is popularly known for a movie adapted from one of his books. And as with you, trout became his metaphor for life. Right now, your book is just a few feet from his. I recently found out that John's books included an autographed copy of A River Runs Through It. So I am convinced that once, at least once, you two met. I would have liked to have been with the two of you together. Do you know this from Trout Magic? I fish because I love to, because I love the environs where trout are found, which are invariably beautiful. I thus escape because in a world where most men seem to spend their lives doing things they hate, my fishing is at once an endless source of delight and an act of small rebellion. Because trout do not lie or cheat, cannot be bought or bribed or impressed by power, but respond only to quietude and humility and endless patience. Because I suspect men are going along this way for the last time, and I, for one, don't want to waste the trip. Because mercifully, there are no telephones on trout waters. Because only in the woods can I find solitude without loneliness. Because bourbon out of an old tin cup always tastes better out there. Because maybe one day I will catch a mermaid. And finally, not because I regard fishing as being so terribly important, but because I suspect that so many of the other concerns of men are equally unimportant. Norman, how did you find middle age? Did your body begin to feel differently? I feel mortal in ways I didn't used to. Were you too struck by the oneness of body and mind? Did your world become less certain, explanations less satisfying, more bewildering? Is that when you began to imagine the words? Because I am a historian, people often ask me what historical person, I think they mean famous and dead, I would most like to spend time with. I always equivocate because I cannot yet quite bring myself to say that I often do spend time with historical persons, some of whom are famous and some of whom are dead. I spend time with you and John and all the others whose thoughts are on my shelves. But that's not the end of it. Your words and the words of the others produce chemical changes in the makeup of my brain as the words interact with each other and as they change me. This is what the neurologists on my shelf say, and it seems right. Yet this thought amazes me. After all, a body is just physical, right? Therefore, my memory must have some physical basis. This, of course, perplexed all thinkers, even before Augustine's beautiful Confessions. The tale is stranger yet. A year ago, I was reading microfilm of my hometown newspaper, the Ishpeming Iron Ore, finding just hints and tidbits of the lives of my great-grandparents, Michael and Emma. I reflected on my experience as I read those old newspapers. Sometimes, Michael, you are dead. The great-grandfather I see at night with the pipe, always erect and old with starched white shirt and tie. Later, I touch your dead folded hand, leaving me with an indentation forever. But here you are young, on the make, on the luminous page of the hometown newspaper, microfilm on the table in front of me, still agile and struggling in that hard rock town where you halted and finally settled down. I roll the reels through your life as your brother's partner, then prosperous owner of your own store and several more, making your money selling to red ore miners who burrow deep for iron. But I frantically search for Emma, sometimes rushing through census records, seeking just a glance at her to reassure me of her presence near you. But she is elusive and appears furtively in small glimpses. Please, Michael, you must find Emma now. And you do with no thought of me. Michael, hurry. You and Emma must marry soon. And you do, but not on my account. But, Michael, I am now thanking you and Emma for letting me be. Norman, you and Michael and Emma and all the others here and alive are here and alive in me. Here in my mind, you and all the others interact in the folded convolutions of my brain as if we were all here having a conversation. It's incredible. Here you all are together in violation of the rules that separate us in place and time. Norman, I'm speaking with a group of people here this evening, and for the sake of civility, I need to talk to them and reluctantly end for the moment this conversation with you. Sincerely, Rob Archibald. My friends, I do want to talk about history in the present tense, and the best place for me to begin is to tell you about the things that most occupy my mind now. These are not the things I thought about a few years ago, although they are a part of it, and something different will consume my mind in the future, although I will remember the outlines of what engages me now. The change is not apocalyptic, but it is inexorable. History has become a tool for self-examination and a search for transcendence, and less a set of facts for explaining the world around me. I am at risk of no longer drawing a line between fact and perception and faith. Let me explain the conversations I have in this room with the people on my shelves. All of the histories on my shelves have beginnings, middles, and ends. In other words, histories are always narratives, always stories. Yet many of the thinkers on my shelves claim that there is no self-evident narrative in the universe, and this seems to make sense to me. The process of the great mysteries around me go forward whether or not I create narratives to explain them. The linguists, the anthropologists, the neurologists, and psychologists on my shelves agree that narrative is simply the way my brain works, a consequence of serendipitous evolution. Stories are simply our method of approximating immediate realities around us well enough to avoid extinction. I do not think that we can extrapolate the inner workings of our biological brains and their chemical processes and assume that the same processes are at work in the universe. It is folly to believe that narration is an adequate tool for explaining existence. Yet narration is an attempt to bring order out of chaos, a valiant and poetic effort to make sense of it all. I do not think that we have really incorporated Albert Einstein's general and special theories of relativity, much less the bizarre predictions of quantum mechanics, into our thinking about reality. There is no evidence in the universe around us for time that pours out in exact little packets of minutes and hours that can be precisely measured. Yet time is a critical component of how we seek to explain existence. Time arises from the narrative, the notion that certain things had to happen first in order for cause and effect to explain them. Some of the friends on my shelves chronicle the efforts of our species to impose precise time ordering on the world and the affairs of humans. Homer, Herodotus, and Thucydides reveal the origins in Western tradition of the efforts to locate events in causal sequences and eventually to create dating systems. Mechanical, electronic, and then atomic clocks allow time to be subdivided into ever more accurate sequences and minuscule durations. Ironically, this ever-increasing ability to measure time led to verification of Einstein's most startling predictions. Time is relative and varies with the speed, position, and direction of the observer. Time that we have become so adept at measuring does not exist in the form we insist on measuring. And yet we persist, for it is a way of ordering our narratives and thinking about our lives. Yet others on my shelves and in my brain convince me that I knew this all along, that all minutes, days, and years are not the same. I intuitively know that I was 5 years old for a much longer time than I was 40. I also know that some minutes, when I am in pain, for example, or when I was six and touched great-grandfather Michael's cold, folded hand, are much longer than those spent reading or looking at a thing of beauty. But if time is relative, how do we incorporate this into our narratives, which is to say, our histories? Even Einstein's brain balked at the conclusions of quantum mechanics. The great physicist Niels Bohr observed, the blue book with the yellow lettering, that anyone who is not shocked by quantum theory has not understood it. I am shocked, and I cannot claim to understand. On the far edges of this theory, and listen to this, is the explanation that everything that can happen does happen. Think of that for a moment. All possible histories, all conceivable narratives happen. Physicist Paul Davies tells me, the brown and gold spine far left shelf, that the existence of an infinite collection of universes and an infinity of times means that anything that is allowed to happen within the scope of quantum fuzziness does happen in at least one of the universes. Is in this world, past, present, and future are all mixed up. This, my friends, is not science fiction, and it does indeed have profound implications for our narratives. It upends the structure we inherited from the primeval origins of life on our planet and evolved over millions of years. But I sense these things are correct. Is it enough to sense something is right? Must I be able to rationally explain? Sometimes alone in my room, I think that I am illogically relating things that are not related, and that I dabble in ideas and disciplines for which I am blatantly unqualified. I persevere in this because I believe that humans in our century has so far deconstructed knowledge that we have made it nigh impossible to know anything for certain. So I pour complexity and chaos theory into this already strange concoction, oversimplifying its implications for my own purposes. This weird but sensible theory simply states that systems in the universe tend towards complexity on the verge of chaos, and this tends to ensure that all possible outcomes will occur in ecology, biology, chemistry, climatology, and physics. Complexity and chaos seem startlingly similar to quantum mechanics applied to the weather, behavior, season, cycles, interpretations, and the Earth itself. Ah, then there is human memory. I think a lot about memory now. It's a part of getting older, which is a process of turning life into memory. Life, after all, is either in the future or its memory. When we are born, it is mainly future, but the older we get, the more of it is memory. So my focus on memory is natural. I have more of it now than I used to. My shelves are dominated by books written by people from many disciplines on memory. Have you read Antonio Damasio's Descartes' Error, Emotion, Reason, and the Human Brain? Our brains, he insists, are not at all like computers. Emotion and feelings are keys to rationality because they allow us to make decisions based on likes and dislikes from past experience, instead of having to sort through all alternatives every time. Emotion is central to what we are and how we think, not peripheral to be trusted less than what we call logic. Gerald Edelman extends the point further in Bright Air, Brilliant Fire on the matter of mind. Dear Plato, the yellow book on the third shelf grimaces. Reality, Edelman insists, is inseparable from being, from the biology that is us. Reality is a function not only of how our brains work, but also of how our bodies work. Memory is a biological process that maps reality well enough to allow us to function in concert with others. It is not a recording device developed to permit us to recall the past with completeness and accuracy. We know this. Every time we compare notes on a past event and encounter difficulty agreeing upon what happened, much less the meanings we have assigned to it. Reality, Robert Ornstein says in The Evolution of Consciousness, is a dream. He says, so our broad, shallow mind tries to link everything together, from linking edges to making a square, to linking falling, flying, sex, business worries into a dream. We're constantly online, reinterpreting our experience and our life. We pick up a sound or light bite, then elaborate on it, creating the dream, the semblance we live within. And the world of experience is thus dreamt, whether it be of a house, a remembrance, or a dream itself. Memory is a construction. Community is the creation of a shared memory, which is why I am so very interested in this topic. So the world and the universe and we turn out to be much more mysterious than I ever imagined. This is leading me to the emotional, the mysterious, the spiritual, the sacred. My scientist friends would leave me here, although they brought me to this place. They, not I, destroyed Newton's mechanistic universe in which there were uniform laws, and you could discern both past and present, past and future, by extrapolating the rules backwards and forwards from the present. No more. I think I knew all of this when I was 8, sleeping on an island in the middle of Lake Michigami, awake at wee hours watching the northern lights. Or today when I saw the blooms on the peony bushes, or this morning when the cat put his paw gently on my face and licked my cheek with his sandpaper tongue. See, I think that our bodies, our senses, and our emotions know these things because they are components of this incredible universe. If the universe is complex to the point of chaos, so are we. If time is relative, we have always known it. If remembering is a process of interaction between past experience and the present, modified by aspirations for the future, we have always done it. If future, past, and present are all garbled, we have always known that there were circles and cycles. So what do you think, Annie Dillard? And from the beige and blue book on the middle shelf, she responds in Teaching a Stone to Talk. I am not going, the child says, I am staying here. Some speculation ensues about who's in charge of granting wishes. We watch the water striders. We are, alas, imagining ourselves in the future, remembering standing here now. The morning light on the green valley and on the clear river, the child playing with the woman's fingers. I had no thought of that before we came, that she would be playing with my fingers, or that we would hear trucks shifting down to climb the hill behind the cottage. We turned to leave. Poets know. We have boxed ourselves with time that does not exist and its corollary progress and have reaped disastrous results. See, I think that what we call progress is just an accumulation. History, too, is an accumulation. But can we know anything? And are there any certainties? I think I agree with Frederick Douglass that there are no bygones. Whether encoded in the stem of our brains, reflected in every gram of our bodies, or in the universe around us, all past is present now in us. History impresses me not with change, but with continuity. But I do think that there are many ways to imagine our world, many narratives to choose from. We are obligated to existence, past, present, and future. Our most sacred obligation is to ensure the continuity that is the message of existence, continuity of this planet, and the continuity of life insofar as we have it within our power to affect them. So I ask, what narratives, what history shall we construct? Narratives have power. Look around and see the power of the narrative of progress that surrounds us. I fear the consequences may be fatal, but I do not question the compelling power of the story. I agree with Bill McKibben when he writes that we live in the age of missing information. And I argue that it is not of a rational, quantifiable kind of information that is missing. Rather, it is poetic, symbolic, emotional kind that links us to one another, to our planet, to the past, and to the future. Isleta Pueblo is just a few miles from Albuquerque. On a hot, dry afternoon, a long time ago, I visited with Tony Lucero under a cottonwood tree just on the outside edge of the Rio Grande floodplain. I brought the loaf of bread. Tony went in the adobe house to get a knife. We sat and talked. Bright, young, pompous historian, I asked Tony about tribal stories of the arrival of the first Spaniards in this valley centuries earlier. I asked him what his people did when they spotted the arriving Europeans. I was taken with the image of what were really almost medieval knights clanking in metal armor in the hot sun traversing the American Southwest. I imagined I could see them in the river valley on the drive from Albuquerque to Santa Fe. Tony pointed to the Manzano Mountains in the distance. My people got on their horses and rode to the mountains to escape the Spaniards, he said. But Tony, I responded, your people did not have horses before the Spaniards brought them. Tony slowly uncrossed his legs, set the slice of bread down, and walked back to the house. Minutes later, he returned and handed me an anthropology textbook. Here, he said. Thank you.